Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Frisch, Judge Hooten, Judge Smith, the Honorable Jennifer Frisch presiding.
Morning, everyone. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is December 9, 2020. We have three cases on for oral argument this morning. This is the second case on our calendar, A20-0207 State versus James. Counsel, please mute your microphones when you are not speaking. As you can see, the marshal has displayed a running clock of your time. Please pay attention to the amount of time that you have remaining in your argument. I'd ask that you identify yourself and your client before you begin your argument. You'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument. The appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. And with that, counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Leah Graff. I represent the appellant Jessica James in this matter. In this criminal sexual conduct case, James asked this court to reverse and remand for a new trial due to the erroneous and prejudicial admission of Spriegel evidence and due to numerous instances of prosecutorial misconduct that denied James her right to a fair trial. In the alternative, James asked the court to remand for resentencing with a correct criminal history score and to vacate the conviction that was entered on count two, which James contends was done in error. The issue that I would like to focus on this morning is the admission of Spriegel evidence. I would note that related to the issue are two exhibits that were confidentially filed in the district court. Both parties have filed confidential and redacted briefs, and my intent would be to refer to them in a manner similar to how they were referred to in publicly filed documents in the district court. So that would be document number 80, which I would refer to as the December 2018 report, and then document number 83, I would refer to simply as the intake report. Turning to the issue at hand, the district court here made findings that both the Spriegel incident and the charged offense showed no plan overall, no design of any sort, no plan on any given occasion, and instead showed propensity. The court then nonetheless admitted the evidence as common scheme or plan evidence.
Well, didn't the court indicate though that the two allegations that were before the court, that the past acts and the prison allegations were linked by common modus operandi or pattern of behavior, not a preconceived, well thought out plan, but it's a same pattern of behavior that would go to the issue of fabrication.
I think that the district court's opinion is sort of internally irreconcilable in the sense that the court seems to suggest that despite the lack of any sort of plan, pattern, design, I think that precludes a finding of marked similar modus operandi. To say that there is some sort of modus operandi in play when the court has said these were not a design or plan or any plan on any given occasion, but instead isolated impulsive acts that were nearly two decades apart.
Can't a modus operandi be an impulsive act? I mean, if you do something and then do something again later, that's sort of the same, or that is the same. I mean, you can act based on impulse or based on opportunity. It doesn't have to be a thought out plan for the evidence to be admitted. I'm not aware of any authority that requires both a plan and that requires a plan in order for Spriegel evidence to be admitted.
Well, I think that when looking at the case law that talks about those measures of marked similarity and, you know, looking for time, place, and modus operandi, those are some sort of measure of plan. And the court here admits the evidence relying on Wormskirchen and its progeny. And that case itself specifically talks about the pattern, ongoing pattern or design that supported the admission of the evidence. And that because of that ongoing pattern, that permitted then this sort of secondary inference of rebutting a claim of fabrication. And Ness talks specifically about Wormiskirchen and the rebutting a claim of fabrication purpose coming under the umbrella of common scheme or plan. Here, the court specifically said these are separate impulsive acts, and that's inconsistent with what Wormiskirchen says. The Wormiskirchen court cites Wigmore for this distinction between design and disposition, and says this is admissible as part of this person's design. And I think that that is where the district court's decision here runs afoul of the cases.
Is the problem really, counsel, the factual findings, or it's just the district court's explanation that to admit a prior act that has a similar modus operandi, it can include admitting that even when there are opportunistic crimes or offenses or bad acts, when the bad acts are opportunistic and not preconceived in advance of doing them, I plan to commit the following X number of assaults and here's how I plan to do it. And the district court rejected the idea of there being what it called an overall plan, or perhaps even planning, it says in the sense of an overall plan, or the sense of a plan on any given occasion. But instead it was an opportunistic type of offense that had the same MO as a previous opportunistic offense. And doesn't the case law support, although there's tension in that the case law recognizes, but nevertheless, doesn't the case law support admitting those types of prior acts when they're opportunistic, similar, markedly similar issues or offenses?
I don't believe that the case law extends as far as the court applied it here. And that was the court recognizing not only the lack of overall plan or design, but the lack of a plan on any given occasion. And also specifically identifying that what the inference was that connected these two events was a propensity inference. That been showed propensity to act. And that is a plainly impermissible purpose. The common scheme or plan doctrine is not an exception to the character evidence rule. There must be some independent inference. And here the court specifically identified the inference as a propensity one, but then nonetheless admits it. And I think that when you look at the language in Wormiskirchen that talks about the difference between design and disposition, that is a boundary that must exist to reconcile the common scheme or plan doctrine with 404B's general broad prohibition on the use of character evidence. So I don't think that the case law extends as far as the court applied.
Right. Well, I'm just wondering whether the issue is more around the district court not it's not a factual finding problem in the district court. It's perhaps a not precisely the same analytical or reasoning issue, but you know, to talk about there's not an overall plan, so it's propensity, but there is this other way to get it in, which is, you know, Wormiskirchen, et cetera. But does that mean that it's reversible? I mean, if in fact, if you looked at the case law and the evidence here, you know, would be sufficient under those cases, even though analyzed slightly differently, we're going to call it a plan if in fact it's a pattern that's repeated. That, you know, is that reversible error or just a difference in sort of under the way that the court wrote about it?
Sure. I think if I'm understanding your question correctly, is this just a problem of framing is maybe what your question is getting at. And I guess I don't think that it is, because we have some very clear findings by the court here. And even so, when you look at these two acts, there's really not marked similarity here. We have one offense occurring when Ms. James was a juvenile, one as an adult. We have one involving use of substances preceding the alleged assault, and no such allegation with regard to something similar happening in the Spriegel incident. And the fact that Ms. James was a juvenile and an adult at these two different times speaks to the incredible time gap that exists between these two events. And that's another place where the district court's decision is faulty here, in that the district court, you know, wanted to sort of account for that time gap by saying that, well, there was a long period during that window, which is about 19 years, where Ms. James didn't have access to potential underage victims. And the record simply doesn't support that. And I think that alone should preclude admission here, given that significant time gap. We have the unique factual scenario where not only does the record not substantiate the district court's determination that there was no access to potential victims for a long period of time, but the record actually shows that James had access to other family member victims, including these very two people, the Spriegel witness and the victim in the current case. So that is a unique scenario where the gap in time has to bear significantly on that relevancy and materiality determination. I think this case brings similar to Ness, where the court there said there wasn't marked similarity, despite the fact that we had a teacher in a supervisory role. Both alleged, the current and Spriegel victims, were in a student role. Both involved inappropriate touching within that relationship. And the court simply said, these are too remote in time to bear sufficient relevance and materiality to be admissible. They're not markedly similar enough for admission, and talked about the lack of any incapacitation or any pattern of ongoing abuse.
But wasn't the court basically finding that the male victims were not of sufficient physical maturity during those years, during that gap? And I mean, not that she didn't live with them, but that they were not of the physical age where, you know, they could have participated in this.
In this particular case, I don't believe so. There is no qualification or explanation by the court about the age of the Spriegel witness during the time that he resided with Ms. James, both in their family home as children, and then subsequently when he was a young man, he resided with Ms. James again. The same is true for the alleged victim in this case. The district court's decision, and I think this court has to take it at its word, is that there was a long period of time which she didn't have access to underage victims. And that is simply not true, given the record that we have.
So, I think that the problem is that children age. And so if the issue is sexually abusing children, her brother aged and she moved away from home, the children that she had were, you know, they have to get to a sufficient age and they age out. I mean, it's not that there was a child living with her for 19 years at and around the ages of 7 to 10. You know what I mean? People age and it changes.
And I don't think that that's what the district court's reasoning was, because that's not what the district court articulated. And even with the Spriegel witness and the alleged victim in the current case, we have an age range. The Spriegel witness is approximately 8 years old at the time of the Spriegel incident. The complaining witness in the current case is 13. So that by itself doesn't truly narrow the window for the district court to sort of implicate without saying, well, there were underage victims there, but they weren't the right age, because we have a built-in range based on the state's proffer of the age range that was, you know, a potential victim in this scenario. So I simply don't think that the district court's reasoning is there, first of all, and I don't think it would hold up or hold water given the facts in this particular case as well. In terms of the other issues with the district court's decision on Spriegel, I believe that the district court also hung its hat on the apparent independent nature of the accounts. Without getting into the specifics of the content, the December 2018 report specifically undermines that proposition that the district court, again, hangs its hat on in terms of addressing relevance and materiality in this particular case. The district court's Spriegel decision was error here and undermines the long-held prohibition on character evidence. The district court's decision ultimately says strong propensity evidence is admissible, and that is simply not what the rules or this court's case law permit. And they don't permit that because ultimately admission of such evidence undermines the defendant's right to a fair trial. And it's James's position that that is what happened in this case.
You don't disagree that there was a curative instruction given at the time this evidence was admitted and during the final instructions. Is that correct?
I see that my time is up. Is it okay that I—
Yes, please.
Okay. There was a cautionary instruction provided shortly after the evidence was admitted and at the close of trial. But State versus Strawman stands for the proposition that if the evidence was admitted in error, the cautionary instruction about Spriegel actually doesn't cure or mitigate any harm, if we're talking about a harmless error analysis, because the instruction is not curative, it's cautionary, and it actually tells the jury to use the evidence to determine guilt. At when, if it's error, there is no permissible purpose and no permissible relevancy for the evidence.
All right, thank you, counsel. Anything else from the panel? You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you very much. Mr. Everson?
Thank you very much, Your Honor, and may it please the court, counsel. My name is Michael Everson, and I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota. This case involves the application of the principle that when a prior incident shares marked similarities to a charged offense, evidence of the prior act has relevance to rebut a defendant's claim of fabrication and to corroborate that the charged act occurred. And I'd like to begin by talking about the district court's discussion of the common scheme and plan use of Spriegel evidence. And I think that can be best understood by taking a look at the Minnesota Supreme Court's discussion in State versus Ness. And this is at pages 687 and 88, where the court is talking about how the common scheme and plan exception was originally reserved for offenses which could be described as part of a pre-planned steps in a larger scheme for which the charged offense was just another step. And the district court in our case correctly recognized that sort of form of common scheme or plan does not fit this case because there was no sort of overarching plan that connects these two acts. However, the Supreme Court in Ness went on to say, and I quote, "The exception evolved, however, to embrace evidence of offenses which, because of their marked similarity and modus operandi to the charged offense, tend to corroborate evidence of the latter." And what the district court was recognizing in its order admitting the Spriegel evidence was that this particular evidence fell squarely within that use of, you know, I would almost describe it as another use of common scheme or plan that does not require an overarching plan. So that is all that the district court was saying in its order here. And I think it is a well-reasoned order and a well-application of established Minnesota law. Now, what the district court also recognized, it then applied the test for whether two acts are markedly similar. The district court correctly held that both instances involved a younger male family member. In both instances, appellant was in a position of authority over the victim. Both instances, appellant perpetrated the acts in her bedroom. Both instances involved her having the victim undress and get on top of her. And in both instances, appellant explained or assisted the younger male in accomplishing penetration. And as these facts indicate, there is a close relationship between the Spriegel Act and the charged offense. Now, much of appellant's argument, both at the district court on appeal, focuses on time. And indeed, there is a gap of time here. But the case law is clear that a gap of time alone does not preclude the admission where two acts otherwise share substantial similarities. You know, ultimately, what district courts must do is they must balance and weigh the time, place, and modus operandi to determine whether or not there is a marked similarity. And again, we have here a district court's well-reasoned order that finds there was marked similarity in this case. And it has been long recognized that district courts are in the best position to do this analysis, hence the abuse of discretion standard. Now, the district court also correctly applied the case law and correctly weighed the probative value against the risk of unfair prejudice. And in doing so, the district court, as well as the state in its appellate brief, cited to substantial case law that recognizes the particularly strong probative value where we have cases involving sexual abuse and the testimony of an underage victim, especially in cases where the defense is alleging motive to fabricate. And that's, again, exactly this case. And this case fits well within that construct where there is particularly strong probative value. In addition, appellant admitted that this prior conduct occurred. So there was no sort of unfair prejudice with having to defend against other factual allegations because there was an admission there. In addition, as Judge Hooten pointed out, there were two cautionary instructions given, which, again, goes to show that the jury in this case was aware of what the proper and improper use of the evidence is. And again, there was strong probative value here. So there was a strong proper use for the jury to make in this case. I'd also like to address appellant's argument about sort of the one line in the district court's order about, you know, if there were evidence that DV knew of the incident between defendant and TV prior to his own initial disclosure, then the marked similarities here might be less striking. Again, this was just the district court noting that there is absolutely no reason to find that DV knew of the prior incident before he reported what happened. And the fact that his account of what happened to him is so strikingly similar to what happened to TV renders this evidence relevant. There was also an argument made about lack of access to victims. And again, what the district court there was doing was simply making a point that there's nothing in the record to indicate that there were younger male family members that she had ready access to during this time period. And the record established what the nature of her family was. So that again is another valid consideration that the district court made when it carefully and did a detailed analysis here. And ultimately the district court did not abuse its discretion in holding that this evidence was admissible. With respect to the prosecutorial misconduct claims, I do believe the briefing lays out the parties' arguments quite well. So unless there are any questions from the panel on that, all I intend to say there is that just to point out that there was no objection to any of the alleged instances of prosecutorial misconduct.
Counsel, can you focus on the argument that there was part of the closing was inflammatory or intended to inflame the passions of the jury, and specifically about the reference to, you know, robbing the victim of his first, et cetera. I mean, why isn't that plainly erroneous?
So I do think it's probably pretty close to being an error. I just don't see it as going into the realm of plain error, because you know the case law that appellant cites is just not in that same category of inflaming the jury. I mean, what the prosecutor, I think, was trying to do here was just to sort of give the context of, look, this is a child who went through a very traumatic experience. And when you judge the child's testimony, you should take that into account. You know, if I was the prosecutor, I probably wouldn't have used that same language. But again, are we in the realm of plain error? I don't think so. And the fact that defense counsel chose not to object and didn't raise the issue, I think indicates to me that the parties at trial didn't consider it to be an error.
What about the eliciting testimony from the appellant regarding prior CHIPS actions that did not seem to play a factual role in this relative to this case?
Sure. So when appellant was on the stand, defense counsel elicited testimony from appellant that kind of described the family, described the role that child protection played in the family. You know, and this is, of course, a case involving intrafamilial sexual abuse. So sort of the nature of the family is a key issue here. And all that the prosecutor did was ask, there was one time before this where child protection was also involved in helping the family. Isn't that right? And at that point, appellant sort of spontaneously disclosed that she had been smoking marijuana. But again, that wasn't something that was asked by the prosecutor. The prosecutor simply asked, had there been some prior help from child protection? So, you know, again, are we talking about plain error? I don't believe we are. So with that, unless there are any other questions from the panel, I do actually just want to add one additional point on the prosecutorial misconduct. Even if this court were to find some isolated incidences of prosecutorial misconduct, again, appellant faces a very high burden to show prejudice. You know, the examples that she cites are relatively isolated examples. This is a lengthy trial over 600 pages of trial transcript. Again, there was no objection indicating that the defense didn't consider it prejudicial, and the defense had a full opportunity to respond to all of the alleged instances of prosecutorial misconduct. So with that, unless there are any other questions from the panel, the state would respectfully ask that this court affirm the conviction under count one, remand for determination of the criminal history score after the parties have had an opportunity to develop the record, and that is consistent with State versus Outlaw, which the state cites in its brief. And we would also agree that this court should vacate and leave unadjudicated count two. So unless there are any questions, thank you very much.
All right, thank you, counsel. Anything else from the panel this morning? All right, thank you very much. Ms. Graff, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to touch on a couple of things on the Spriegel issue, and then I'll respond more in detail to the prosecutorial misconduct arguments that respondents made. I think that the district court did more here than just say there's no overall plan. I'm not asking the court to revert to an old version of the common scheme or plan doctrine, but simply apply it as it's articulated in Wormeskirchen, which looks still, and in Ness, looks still to those factors of time, place, and modus operandi, and for marked similarity, as some sort of measure of plan. Without any measure of that, then we are simply left with a character inference. And the character inference is what the court found the two incidences showed in this case. As to the independent nature of the accounts, the court was considering only the independence in one direction. That is, did DV have any reason to know or any opportunity to know of the details of TV's account? The court failed to consider the independence in terms of the other direction. And the record here shows that there is no specific detailed account of TV's report that is contemporaneous. The December 2018 report is the report that, again, is confidentially filed, so I won't refer to the details, but that is the follow-up interview, or the interview, I should say, with TV. That the taking of that information from him comes nearly 9 months after Ms. James was charged. And so reviewing that document undermines any assumption that these are wholly independent accounts. Again, Ms. James had access to younger individuals. That includes TV, DV, younger brothers, and the record is absent of any information as to her living situation beyond that. As to prosecutorial misconduct, respondent has mentioned a couple of times that there was no objection, but that is already accounted for in the plain error standard that James has argued under. And so I don't think it's a separate factor to sort of suggest there was no error or no plain error, and that if there were, it didn't undermine the fairness and integrity of the judicial proceedings. In this case, we have serious misconduct in the sense that Judge Smith noted a particularly egregious example, the prosecutor referring to DV's loss of virginity. Similarly, the prosecutor argued about or sort of speculated about the fact that DV would forever be reminded or forever be harmed in any future sexual encounter because of James's conduct. In doing so, the prosecutor likened him to TV in that same moment in closing argument. Not only is this plainly inflammatory, and I think McNeil, State versus McNeil, supports that. It has nothing to do with the elements of the charged offense, the notion that his future sexual encounters would be ruined by this. And it compounds the errors here because in doing so, the prosecutor likens TV and DV to one another. So we have inflammatory argument by the state that really is interwoven then with sort of the prejudice of the Spriegel evidence. The court there is inviting the jury to treat them in the same way. And that happened throughout trial in the sense that the prosecutor also argued in closing, that DV wanted Ms. James to be normal and to deal with the things she hadn't dealt with when she abused her brother. Again, this is inviting propensity argument, propensity inference by the jury. These are not isolated incidents. This was a theme in the prosecutor's closing in the sense that she asked the jury to stand in DV's shoes repeatedly throughout closing. There was eliciting of inadmissible testimony that the district court identified, and there was failure to prepare a witness. This misconduct permeated this entire trial. And the argument that was inflammatory is particularly concerning when the district court called out the prosecutor in opening and said, stay away from things about robbing of innocence. Under these circumstances, I believe that the prosecutorial misconduct did deny her a fair trial.
All right, thank you. Anything else from the panel? All right, thank you very much, counsel. The matter is submitted. We will issue an opinion within the statutory time period. Thank you so much. We'll stand in recess until our next case. Thank you.
Thank you.